Thank you, Wendell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Laughter? This is strange. Things have changed. Pharisees get a very bad rap. At worst, if you think about this, we demonize them, but even at the best, we often mock them in our faith. Well, there's an old Sunday school song I remember when I was a kid called "I Just Want to Be a Sheep." And in this profound song, there's a seemingly deep verse that says, "I don't want to be a Pharisee. Don't want to be a Pharisee. Because a Pharisee's not fair, you see. Don't want to be a Pharisee." But if you think about it for a moment, think what the Pharisees were actually doing. They were trying to make religion accessible to the common man. They set aside those complicated matters, you know, complex concepts like justice, mercy, and faithfulness, and those difficult topics requiring great depth of thought, and instead focused on simple rules that anyone could follow, like how much mint and cumin should be tithed. I mean, imagine just for a moment how much easier it would be to be a believer if, instead of laboring to show love as an outward sign of our faith, instead Greg Weaver just gave us all a Hawaiian shirt to wear as a sign of who we are. That would be easier, right? Maybe not for the fashionably minded ones in our midst, but easier for others. Now, before anyone shouts heretic or Wendell suffers an aneurysm, I'm joking, of course, right? Please don't miss my sarcasm. There are many reasons why our Lord pronounced woes upon the Pharisees. There's a reason why he, in Matthew 23, reserved colorful language for them, calling these religious leaders children of hell, whitewashed tombs, blind fools. Indeed, while very elementary in its language, that old song, "I Don't Want to Be a Pharisee," is not so far off when it says the Pharisee's not fair. You see, maybe not a great pun, but the point is there that it's well known one of their core sins was hypocrisy. And Christ indicts them in Matthew 23 six times with the word hypocrites. This morning, though, I want to focus on two other Pharisaical flaws. Our purpose is going to be to look at those flaws among the Pharisees and consider how they might creep into our response to abortion. Indeed, I want to consider how to be a pro-life Pharisee and, more importantly, how to avoid it. We're going to consider two errors. First, how they perverted their mission. And secondly, how they confused what was essential. And these two errors, perverting their mission, confusing the essential matters, they make a very simple acronym for ME. Very easy to follow, right? ME, which points to the heart of the problem. The Pharisees' focus was not on God, but on themselves. And when we follow in their spirit today, whether it be in pro-life work or something else entirely, we're making the same mistake of focus. So we're going to conclude today, after looking at their errors, conclude that the answer for how to not be a pro-life Pharisee is the same answer Christ gave years ago to the Pharisees we read about in the New Testament, which is a properly oriented focus. So back to Sunday school jokes, because they're fun sometimes. There's an old joke that a Sunday school teacher asked her class to define a Pharisee. And one student, let's call him Johnny, raised his hand and said, "I know what a Pharisee is." And the teacher said, "Okay, Johnny, what's a Pharisee?" And he said, "It's a horse." The teacher said, "What do you mean? A horse? Why a horse?" He said, "Well, because Jesus said, woe to the Pharisees." Now, I'm sorry, I know that puns may not be your thing. I know this church is a very high bar for humor. Preferring jokes where the punchline is something, you know, accessible to the common man, that something everyone can relate to, like ancient Nestorianism or Arianism or something like that. But there's a purpose for this pun, and that is that the kid in the joke represents a lack of understanding of the mission of the Pharisees, what their role was, who they were. Understanding their role, their mission, is necessary for us to grasp how they perverted it, which is the first of the two flaws I want to consider this morning. Now, Matthew 23, again, Jesus pronounces many woes on the Pharisees. But before he gets to the woes, Christ references the mission, the job of the Pharisees. In verses 1 through 3, we read this. "Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, 'The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. So do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do. For they preach, but they do not practice.'" Christian Scriptures professor David Garland, commenting on this passage, notes that Jesus here begins his attack on the Pharisees by conceding their authority, the authority of the scribes and Pharisees. To be on Moses' seat was to be an expert expounding the law. So the Pharisees had a legitimate role. They had teaching authority. But Garland clarifies here that Jesus is not giving a blanket endorsement of their authority. And indeed, the woes section makes clear that those whose deeds contradict their teaching, when that happens, they disqualify themselves, and that's what the Pharisees did. But what's important to note here is that Christ is not condemning the role, the office of the Pharisees. He's condemning their fulfillment of their duties. They had a legitimate role as experts of the law, the Mosaic law, and their job was to teach it. The problem was they perverted this mission, seeking seats of honor, using religious opportunities and symbols even as opportunities to be noticed. They were supposed to lead the people to understand the law, but the honor of their position became the substance of their mission as they sought self-exaltation. It began as a legitimate task, and then it ended in a pursuit for personal interest. Now, Professor Garland, in his commentary on this passage, he writes, "The opponents of Jesus did not have a corner, though, on hypocrisy, arrogance, and injustice. One should look within one's own life and one's own religious circle to see where these denunciations apply to us." So when I read this about the Pharisees, what I think we ought to do is ask, well, where are we tempted to follow in their footsteps, even if it's subtle? And this morning, my question is, could it be that sometimes our response to abortion may follow subtly in their footsteps? Now, I want to begin by pointing the finger at myself, because the danger of following the Pharisees is not a danger to which I am in some way immune. Not at all. Years ago, when, as Wendell said, I abandoned tech, we began full-time pro-life work. I remember being at the University of Maryland many years ago, and there was a college professor who walked out of her class, brought her class to our display for her whole class to see it, and then she and I started engaging in dialogue with her whole class listening to us. And afterward, I watched the footage of our back-and-forth exchange, and I was generally pleased with the content, but I noticed something in my demeanor. It was subtle, but I could hear it in my tone. It was an occasional air of condescension. I mean, I was a kid, and here I was talking to a college professor, someone who was, on all accounts, my cultural superior. Indeed, she was someone to whom I probably in all ways should have looked up to. I mean, let's be honest, probably even physically. And yet, in spite of that, I had better answers than her. This college prof, my superior, but I had better answers. That manifested in some brief arrogance. It was brief, but I took note of it. Now, if you fast forward to today, when Courage Equals team walks into a college campus, we know the arguments we're going to hear that day. Indeed, I've often joked that I could probably present a better pro-abortion case than the people holding those Planned Parenthood signs and selling cupcakes in the shapes of things I'm not going to mention. Not only have we heard seemingly every argument so many times, but we go back to our office and hammer out the best apologetic answers. It's easy to think that we know how to answer everything we're going to hear. Now, I think it's pretty easy to see how that could lead to self-exaltation. If I think I know all the answers, I'm sorry, all the questions and all the answers, it's pretty easy for the people to whom I speak to become two-dimensional opportunities to prove I know the answers instead of the three-dimensional image bearers of God that they are. In other words, the mission I've set out on becomes an opportunity to elevate myself and prove my intellectual prowess. The Pharisees turned authority into an opportunity for self-exaltation. I must fight temptation to turn our mission into the same. Now, could others face that same temptation in the movement? I don't know. I only have access to one person's motives, my own. But I've noticed a trend which, if not checked, could lead into a similar twisting of mission into personal interest. And it's a subtle one. What I'm speaking of is a tendency to turn the study of apologetics into mere intellectual gratification while leaving behind cultural engagement. Now, as a side note here, there is still not enough widespread interest in pro-life apologetics. There are vast swaths of our movement where people oppose abortion but can't communicate why they oppose it. I'm not directing myself to those groups this morning. I'm speaking to those who have an embarrassment of apologetic riches. Whether you say apologetics, giving a defense, case-making, the name doesn't matter. Whatever you call it, the purpose is the same, to lead people to truth. Yet while we've had great apologetic pro-life advances, in my very limited experience, sometimes these fail to bring forth equal earnest in reaching our culture with those answers that we now have. I mean, I've at times been struck talking to someone who has sat through hours of training with really some of the best pro-life apologists we have, and see them tremble at the thought of actually talking with someone who disagrees with them on abortion. This suggests to me that for all of our training, many times we have very little experience actually talking to non-pro-life people about abortion. Now, when a soldier completes boot camp, we should not minimize his accomplishment going through boot camp, but we'd be mistaken to clap him on the back and say, "Good job, your work is done, you did it," because that's just the beginning of their work. It's only just begun. And so pro-life apologetic training should be the same, geared toward actual service of some kind. And yet sometimes we spend hours in the classroom, sometimes poring over and preparing for objections that really no one is even raising these days on the actual streets. And then these hours in the classroom fail to produce equal time log talking to people, pro-abortion colleagues, family members, neighbors, about abortion. Sometimes people spend year after year going to pro-life seminars, but they can count on one hand the number of times they've actually talked to people who don't agree with them on abortion. Now, I don't know what the reason for all this is, but could it be, a question I have is, could it be that our apologetic study may be leading to a sort of pro-life scholasticism in which the study itself becomes the end goal rather than changing actual minds on abortion? If so, that may certainly scratch an intellectual itch, but it's pretty cold comfort to 2,500 people dying today. We must face squarely the temptation to fall in love with the intellectual nature of apologetics while foregoing the primary reason we began to study it. My favorite apologist, whom I think many here love as well, is Francis Schaeffer. In his classic work, The God Who Is There, Schaeffer writes about this very temptation. He writes this: apologetics should not be merely an academic subject, a new kind of scholasticism. It should be thought out and practiced in the rough and tumble of living contact with the present generation. Now, it is not less than books and seminars. It is that, but it's so much more as well. It's real-life dialogue with real people, sometimes clumsy, often very awkward, but all pointed toward the goal of leading people to truth. Indeed, Schaeffer, not only did he so ardently opposed efforts to render apologetics merely an intellectual pursuit that he later writes this in the same book: "I am not an apologete, if that means building a safe house to live in, so that we Christians can sit inside with safety and quiescence. Christians should be out in the midst of the world as both witnesses and salt, not sitting in a fortress surrounded by a moat." That final line there hangs in our office on our wall, where our team members walk by every time they leave the office to go engage the culture, because we must remember that all of us, I think, can fall into this. We must remember that our study of apologetics should not be an opportunity to exalt our intellect. The death of babies should never be an opportunity to prove how smart we are. Rather, the purpose is to talk to real people, save real lives, and make real progress. Now, I know a quick response to this may be, but hang on a second. Apologetics isn't just to reach people. It's also to solidify our convictions, provide confidence, enjoy discovering truth. And all of that is very true. But these are not mutually exclusive pursuits. We can do both. We can strengthen ourselves and reach others. We can satisfy the intellect while not exalting it higher than we ought to, while also engaging the real people of our culture. And indeed, I think that if we're out on the streets talking to real people, seeking to change real minds, that what happens is that actually we become even more confident as we learn the answers even more. So please don't misunderstand me. I do not mean to condemn a love of apologetics or interest in deeper study. Those are good, valuable, spiritual things. What I want to warn, I guess, is allowing the intellectual pursuit of pro-life apologetics to become our sole end goal. In this movement, we need professional thinkers finding the best answers for us. But I submit to you that what we need even more than that are willing foot soldiers taking those answers to the people. We need stay-at-home moms, educators, medical professionals making a case where they are. We need full-time pro-life workers leading teams to the streets, to places to talk to people, to create public dialogue. Our greatest need is not people to think up new ideas. Our greatest need is people willing to communicate those ideas. Now, the Pharisees were wrong to turn teaching Jews about the law into an opportunity for self-exaltation. I think we'd also be wrong to turn rescuing babies into an opportunity for exalting intellect. Now, next, I'd like you to consider a question, a pretty easy one, I think. What is the essential purpose of a dictionary? Anyone? What's a dictionary for? Mm-hmm. Find words, right? That's the essential purpose of a dictionary. Finding the meaning of words. Years ago, Rebecca Birch, whom you may know as a kind, sweethearted soul, she found that dictionaries also have a secondary purpose. If you can find one of those big, thick, fat ones, they're really effective in waking up your sleeping cousin if you drop them on his back. Yes, I was that cousin. And yes, it was a long time ago, so I've forgiven her, though I was having back pain just last week. But what if someone today were to suggest the essential purpose of a dictionary is to wake people up by dropping it on their back? They'd be confusing a possible secondary purpose of dictionaries with the real reason dictionaries exist, which is to help us find words, right? They'd be confusing secondary purposes with the essential purpose of a dictionary. That brings us to our second flaw of the Pharisees for this morning, and that is essentials. In addition to turning their mission into an opportunity for self-exaltation, the Pharisees also confused essential and secondary matters. In Matthew 23:23, so again, we're in the section where Jesus pronounces woes on the Pharisees. In Matthew 23:23, Christ says this, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others, you blind guides, straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel." Now, Jesus here does not condemn their tithe of herbs, but rather their confusion of what is essential with other matters. They interpreted the law to create more burdensome exacting requirements than the Mosaic law actually reads, while totally neglecting things that echo through the law, big things like justice and mercy and faithfulness. But this confusion is not unique to the Pharisees Jesus talked to. We see it in other groups as well. One of the most well-known Pharisees of the New Testament is the Apostle Paul. We know he's a Pharisee. In Acts 23, he declares this, "I'm a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee." And this man, this Pharisee, was changed when he met Jesus on the road to Damascus, of course, changed the course of his life. And it's interesting watching Paul's ministry, where this Pharisee converted to Christianity, then has to deal with some people who are following and making the same mistakes as the Pharisees Jesus tangled with, people who are exchanging secondary matters or non-important matters with the essential things. For example, in the book of Galatians, Paul condemns the Judaizers who seek to heap extra burdens on the Christians by preaching a false gospel requiring circumcision. And really, you can't miss the frustration in Paul's pen as you read the book of Galatians. He's angry because many Christians had listened to the Judaizers saying, "You can't be a Christian unless you are circumcised." And this recalls the Pharisees talking to Jesus, who said, "You can't be a follower of God unless you follow our direction on tithing mint and dill and cumin." They're adding extra burdens. Now, the first danger we considered of apologetics becoming perhaps an exaltation of intellect rather than cultural engagement, that was a subtle trend. This trend here of making non-essential things essential matters is anything but subtle. Anyone truly who spent more than a few seconds in the pro-life movement has likely heard someone say, "You can't really be pro-life unless you support this or unless you oppose that." Now, I'm not talking about people who say, "You can't be pro-life and unless you also oppose war," opponents of ours. I'm not talking about them, people who say that. Rather, I'm referring to people in our ranks, people who are pro-life, who say things like this. "You're not really pro-life unless you oppose all methods of birth control, even those which do not cause early abortions, barrier methods. You're not really pro-life unless you vote for or against a certain bill. You're not really pro-life unless you boycott this certain product." These are all people on our side who make being pro-life more burdensome than it must be. Now, in the same way that Christ did not condemn the tithing of garden crops like mint and dill and cumin, I am not suggesting we put aside our convictions on these matters. These are important things to debate and discuss. My point is this. We must distinguish what is essential to a pro-life ethic and a lifestyle consistent with that from secondary matters. In other words, what must we all agree on and what is open to debate? Here's where we can begin, I think. Here's something we should all agree on, the very basic reason abortion is wrong. You've heard it before, it's very familiar to you. It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Elective abortion does that. It intentionally kills innocent human beings. Thus, elective abortion is wrong. That's the essential statement of the pro-life movement. We should all agree here. And so views which conflict with this must be vigorously corrected. For example, some people say, "I'm pro-life, and yet abortion is permissible in the cases of rape and incest." Or others say, "Well, abortion, I'm pro-life, but abortion's really only wrong after viability when the baby could survive outside the womb," or "abortion's really only wrong when the baby feels pain." Those views necessarily conflict with that, the essential view of our movement. So they must be corrected, because the pro-life view is that it is wrong to intentionally kill any baby, whether she was made in violence or in love, regardless of how dependent she is on her mother, whether she can feel pain or not. Those are irrelevant matters. So on these issues, I think we must agree, or we should agree. I say should because we can hold, of course, inconsistent views. But I would put, if I think of categories like essential and secondary, I would put consistent opposition to elective abortion in the essential category. That's worth contending over. Or not just contending, I'm sorry. That's an area we should all agree on. I would also put in this category correct reasoning to what is essential, things we should all agree on. Because some people come to the right conclusion that abortion is wrong, but for the wrong reasons. And that's problematic as well. Like some say abortion is wrong because it harms the mother. Now, we're glad those people are pro-life, right, that they oppose abortion, but we should correct that reasoning because it leads to some dangerous areas. If abortion is wrong because of how it harms some women, physically or emotionally, what about other women who say that abortion was great for them? If your subjective experience makes abortion right or wrong, that changes whether abortion is right or wrong based on your personal experience. So we have to correct that as well. So essential things we should all agree on are at least this, consistent opposition to all elective abortion and correct reasoning on why abortion is wrong, not because of potential harm to a mother, but because it intentionally kills innocent humans. So defending the essence of the pro-life view, I think, is this, correcting views which conflict with it as well as those which have the same conclusion but for faulty reasoning. Those are essential matters. But then there are secondary matters. And I know this church is familiar with the three concentric circles of the faith, right? You have center circle, things we must all agree on. Then you have other issues. Things not in the center are those we debate about, we're not going to divide over. You can kind of think of this in a similar way. It's not exactly the same. But the topics I'm about to mention are similar in that we contend for them, debate them, but they're not essential to a consistent pro-life view or ethic. And the reason is because, in my opinion at least, and I'm open to correction for sure on this, but when I think of the essential principle why abortion is wrong, that it intentionally kills innocent humans, I don't think that principle necessarily leads to one side or the other in the debates we're about to reference. And that's why I don't think it's essential to the pro-life view. So these are often ethical matters that are related, or they can be responses to abortion, debates on those kinds of things. So the question I ask when I hear these debates is either position required by the core reason we oppose abortion? And here's one example. How to save the mother's life. Now, we all know ectopic pregnancy, that means the baby implants not where she should in the uterus, but outside the uterus, somewhere else, often in the fallopian tube. The pro-life ethic certainly allows the rescuing of the mother's life, but we don't all agree on how we should save her, and maybe you're not aware of this debate because it's not talked about it a lot, but people do debate this. How should we save the mother's life? Some say we must never act directly on the baby's body. We must only treat the larger pathological problem. So you must do a salpingectomy, removing the part of the fallopian tube wherein the baby has implanted. Baby will die, of course, but mother is rescued. Others argue, well, no, you could take a more direct action using something like the drug methotrexate. The baby dies and later the dead baby is removed. Two views on how to save the mother's life. But critically, though, here's the important point. Whether the action is direct or indirect, how you save the mother, in neither of these options is the baby's death intended. If we could rescue her, we would do so. She doesn't die because we want her to die. Rather, we lack technological means today to save her. So neither of these options, directly, indirectly saving the mother, neither of these violates the basic reason abortion is wrong, that it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. In both cases, the baby's death is foreseen but not intended. And I have friends, leaders in the movement on both sides of this debate, and they are, in my opinion, ardently and consistently pro-life. That's one example. Here's another one, maybe an easier one, capital punishment. Opposing intentionally killing innocent humans does not necessarily lead to a pro- or anti-capital punishment position. Now, again, remember, there may be good other reasons for taking a side in this debate, but neither one is required by the core pro-life view. Those who oppose death row are not necessarily inconsistent, and neither are those who support the state executing guilty people. For opposition to abortion is intentionally killing the innocent people. As a side note here, this is why one of the reasons I prefer the label anti-abortion, because it makes very clear what we're talking about. Pro-life is a bit more nebulous. Like, what does it mean on capital punishment? Anti-abortion's a little clearer. So here's a third example that hits closer to home for me, and that is the use of abortion victim photography. You're very familiar with the work that we do. You know, if you've listened to us before, you know that I think there's compelling qualitative and quantitative evidence demonstrating using abortion victim photos is perhaps the fastest, most effective way to awaken hearts and change minds on abortion. I will ardently contend for that conclusion. But not all who oppose our use of victim photos do so for the same reason. Some I encounter disagree. Some of them may be unwilling to look at evidence. Some are afraid of losing their reputation. Those are character flaws I think we should correct. But it would be unfair of me to paint everyone who disagrees on this with the same broad brush. Some people may just be convinced they have a better way. They're not less interested in saving babies' lives. We just disagree on the best way to do it. Again, I think they are wrong, and I will argue for my position, but for me to say they're not pro-life would be a bogus charge which elevates my secondary position to the level of essential, which I ought not to do. Now, how about an uncontroversial example? Vaccination. I'm going to wait in this a little bit, not very much. Why do I put this in a secondary category? Why do I think neither side of this very heated debate is required by a consistent pro-life position? It's not because I don't think it's important. I do. Rather, when I consider the essential principle which unites the anti-abortion, the pro-life movement, that it is wrong to intentionally kill innocent humans, I don't see how that premise could necessarily lead to either position in this vaccination debate. It seems to me that the debate on vaccination centers on a different question, related but different, and that is it moral to take advantage of medical advances which were created through unethical means? Very important question, but distinct. Is it moral to take advantage of those things acquired through unethical means? That's related but distinct, and so I'm not going to wade into that this morning. I leave it in Wendell's very capable hands. My goal is far more modest, just to demonstrate that opposition to elective abortion does not require one to hold a pro- or anti-vaccination position. Now, again, there may be very good compelling reasons to take a side in this debate. But again, my purpose is far more modest, just to ask, is either position required by the pro-life view? I don't think so. I'm not sure, but I don't think so. I don't see how. Now, if vaccination could be demonstrated to violate the essential principle why abortion is wrong, in other words, if vaccination were intentionally killing innocent humans or necessarily causing that to be done, then yeah, it makes sense to put it in the essential category, the essential pro-life category. Remember, we're talking about a pro-life view, not just the broad what is essential to our life, but when it comes to pro-life things, what is essential. But unless we can demonstrate that, a position on one side or the other, I don't think is essential to a consistent pro-life view. So one final example here for the essential and secondary matters, and that is legislation. You might remember my message last year. My whole message was on the immediatism versus incrementalism debate. You have two sides, and on one side are those who say, the immediatists saying that any bills falling short of a total ban on abortions should not be pursued. On the other side are those incrementalists saying, well, no, making increments toward the goal are worth pursuing. The crucial point here is that both sides are taking positions to fight abortion legislatively. You may disagree with the other side, but to say they're not living consistently with the pro-life ethic would be false. The disagreement is not whether abortion is wrong or whether we should end it. Rather, the dispute is how to do that. And this way, it recalls the dispute on saving the mother's life. Both sides agree, yes, save her. The debate is how. Here, both sides agree, yes, fight abortion legislatively. The question is how. Newsflash, one can be pro-life and be an immediatist. One can be pro-life and be an incrementalist. And yet, in this debate, so often one side casts the other, one side or the other, both do this, as casting the other one as not being really pro-life or not pro-life enough. I've seen it on both sides. And here's where the true Pharisaical spirit comes to great fruition. I've watched incrementalists publicly fight bills they see as too radical. I've seen incrementalists fight those who support these bills as being too radical. I've seen immediatists charge people who've labored for decades fighting for incrementally ending abortion, saying they're guilty of lining their pockets with blood money. Just recently, I sat down with a friend who has staked out a position in this. He suggested not only that people on the other side of this legislative debate are not pro-life, but charged them with being the reason abortion is legal. This really is not right. And in Ohio, 8 years of a bitter divide on this have led to a place where certain individuals in our movement will not speak to each other, won't even be in the same room together. This divided house cannot stand. Now, if this were a matter of essential importance, it would be worth dividing over. But again, we have to ask, why do these individuals in these debates hold the positions they do? Does someone truly want to frustrate the legislative goal of ending abortion? If so, yeah, let's correct that. But such charges are often made totally devoid of any evidence. They're groundless assertions. A consistent pro-life ethic does lead to the conclusion abortion should be banned, but it does not logically entail one method over the other. So our assertions of you're not pro-life unless ... usually amount to just clanging gongs and noisy gongs and clanging cymbals. These often are just examples, and it, not beyond that, they actually make us not only divide us and cause bitter divisions as a group, but they make us far less effective, as now we're fighting each other and not reaching the goals we set out to achieve. The Pharisees were wrong to confuse weighty matters of the law with their burdensome interpretations and requiring others to take those on. We must also resist temptation to take our personal convictions on these secondary matters and elevate them to the role of essential, leading to divisions and also removing our effectiveness as we try to reach the goal of rescuing babies. Now, this morning we began with the old Sunday school song, which teaches us that Pharisees aren't fair. But this morning we considered two other Pharisaical flaws. We looked first at taking advantage of the mission for personal interest. The Pharisees had a task to do. They turned that task into a pursuit of personal glory. For some pro-lifers, maybe there may be a similar danger of a type of intellectualism whereby abortion becomes merely a scholastic opportunity. Second, we looked at confusing essential matters with secondary matters. The Pharisees traded major issues like mercy with burdensome interpretations of the law. Many in our ranks, at least I have seen many in our ranks, turning personal convictions into essential matters, creating burdensome, making it burdensome to be pro-life and dividing people, causing unnecessary division and displaying a shocking lack of charity often toward their brothers and sisters working toward the very same goal. So in all this, though, what is the solution? We know the problem. What do? These trends, in my opinion, have something in common. They're different, but they have a uniting thread, and that is a misguided spirituality. The Pharisees were focused on themselves, me, my glory, my burdensome interpretations of the law. Proper spirituality is a life oriented toward God, honoring Him. They pointed to themselves. A pro-life Pharisaical spirit today makes the very same error. Whether it be elevating ourselves or our personal convictions, either way, we begin to put ourselves in the center. And so our solution is the very same one that Jesus gave to the Pharisees. We've been talking about Matthew 23, the woes to the Pharisees. The very chapter before that, Matthew 22, in that chapter we see one Pharisee try to test Jesus, asking, "What is the greatest commandment?" I don't think he anticipated Jesus' response, which is this. He told the Pharisee, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Now, perhaps the Pharisees wanted to catch Jesus, elevating some doctrine they found unimportant, you know, something useless like justice or something. But instead, Jesus called them to a radical reorientation of life. To orient your life around God, to love Him with your entire being, and love your neighbor as yourself. The me only comes in as an illustration. Love God with your being and your neighbor as yourself. If we want to avoid being pro-life Pharisees, our solution is the same. It requires a radical reorientation. So we should not respond to, for example, the dangers of intellectualism by creating some new legalism whereby we say, okay, in every conversation, everyone has to talk about abortion all the time. That would be swapping one manifestation of a Pharisaical spirit for another. Instead, what we need is a radical reorientation, focusing on God with our whole being and loving our neighbors. I think if we do that, we won't be tempted to turn the mission into some opportunity for self-interest. We won't be tempted to condemn those who hold different convictions on issues which are secondary. We'll debate those issues, we'll contend for our views on them, but we won't be tempted to tell other people on different sides that they're not pro-life. If we remember the broken bodies stacking up across our nation, we will be disgusted by the temptation to turn their deaths into some kind of scholasticism. If we strive to love our fellow soldiers, who may not be in lockstep with us on secondary matters, we're not going to blast them on Facebook. It just won't happen. If we love God with our entire being, He will enable us to resist all of this. And that is truly how we can avoid being pro-life Pharisees.